So after the beautiful introduction given by Charlie, I'd like to hopefully talk about something that complements his talk. So you will have several parts. One is during the course of his talk, there have been many questions asked because the definition that was initially given for the topological insulator was literally for a topological band insulator. You need well-defined momentum, you need scan dispersion, and so on. But after all, we're making a stronger claim. We're saying that this is really a new state of matter, and a new state of topological state of matter. And this should be, a definition should be given, which is totally independent of whether you're using interacting or non-interacting picture, whether it's disorder or no disorder, and so on and so forth. So one of the first part of the talk is to tell you, especially for people like David, that the topological insulator is nothing but a long sought after theta vacuum with theta equals to pi. And I will tell you all about, and you will see that all the reasoning will eventually lead to a connection with Charlie's talk. And then I will hopefully review a little bit about the microscopic material, which leads to this type of behavior. And towards the very last of my talk, and in the spirit of Leon's email of sharing the latest thing that just came out, is I'd like to tell you about topological insulator at room temperature. So I hope that's the order I'd like to go. So first of all, the work done at Stanford Group is over several years, and we had people like Andrew Bernabic, who was a very important and active contributor to this work, now at Princeton. Hong Jun Wu was at Stanford and now at UCSD, and Xiao Liang Qi and Taylor Hughes, and I will also. And they are currently at Stanford. So this is really a collective effort. So what I'm going to tell you is that the whole entire concept of topological insulator is captured by one equation. And that equation is that the effective topological field theory for the topological insulator is the so-called theta vacuum term, which in conventional language is just E dot B. With the universal coefficient theta, which is either zero or pi, and the z2-ness is nothing but theta for a time-reversal invariant insulator under the periodic boundary condition, can only take two values, either theta equals to zero or theta equals to pi. But this leads to many interesting and profound physics, and one of them is a very earlier prediction made by Witten that a monopole will have electric charge and vice versa, and that leads to the following effect, that if you put an electron on the top of the topological insulator, it will induce a magnetic monopole as its image charge, and that we believe is very easily measurable. So what we are doing here is that we're searching for new states of matter. For example, in chemistry, people 100 years ago were looking for new elements, and then led to a golden age of chemistry. In particle physics, we're looking for new particles, and that's why we're building SSC. And so in condensed matter physics, we're looking for interesting ways how matters can organize themselves into different phases. But almost like 95% of the states in condensed matter, they are all kind of categorized by a broken symmetry. For example, the crystal breaks the translational symmetry, the magnet breaks rotational symmetry, superconductor breaks something more subtle, but nonetheless just a gauge symmetry. But the quantum Hall effect gave us a new example, which is topologically non-trivial state of matter. The way it is different from any ordinary states of matter is not because it broke the symmetry slightly differently, but because it's topologically distinct. And of course, you have the quantized Hall conductance, and Charlie explained very nicely that the quantized Hall conductance in a non-interacting picture is nothing but the first trend number integrated over the Brillouin zone. But perhaps a more generic definition of a new topological state of matter is that it is something that is defined by a topological field theory. So the quantum Hall state is actually defined by the Trans-Simons effective field theory. And out of the Trans-Simons effective field theory, first of all, it's more generally valid. It's valid both for integer quantum Hall effect and fractional quantum Hall effect, whereas this formula is only valid for the integer quantum Hall effect. It also is independent of disorder or strong interactions, as long as you have a nice gap in the system. You can imagine integrating out all the microscopic degree of freedom and obtain an effective field theory, and then it gives you kind of the most general definition of the state. But also, the physically measurable topological consequences are easily extracted from a topological field theory, such as the Trans-Simons theory. So the main question I'd like to ask about today is what is the topological field theory for the topological insulator? So let me give you a very elementary introduction. So let's, after all, we're talking about the insulator. So let's try to imagine what is the electromagnetic response of the insulator. So insulator has, because it's insulating, it allows us to define locally inside the insulator the electric field and the magnetic field. So then in the spirit of a Landau-Ginzburg type of effective field theory approach, you can write down the effective action for insulator, which is just E squared minus V squared. And you generally allow some phenomenological coefficients, such as epsilon and mu, and that defines the dielectrical response and the magnetic permeability. So now, also in the spirit of the Landau-Ginzburg, you say, well, let's try to add all the terms that are allowed by symmetry, that is quadratic, defining a linear response, and to contain quadratic orders in derivatives. So now, in the Maxwell type of effective theory, there's only one other term which satisfies that, and that's the E dot B term. Okay, so you can have action contribution to the action, effective action, which is of the form of E dot V. And if you make all the units right, you can have alpha here, which is a fine structure constant, and then there's a general theta parameter allowed. So now, this term, if it is possible, who would be motivated in writing down such a term? You would be motivated if the crystal is magnetoelectric. In the sense that if you apply magnetic field, so this equation will tell you that to apply magnetic field will induce electric polarization, and vice versa. If you apply the electric field, it will induce a magnetic polarization. And so if you find somehow a magnetoelectric crystal, that's the most natural instinctive response you would have. You say, oh, let me try to describe it by E dot B term to describe such a mixing effect between E and B. Now, of course, you should consider the constraints bound the symmetries. So, for example, you like to consider the time reversal symmetry. Now, under time reversal symmetry, E goes to E, but B goes to minus B. So, therefore, this term changes sign, and theta goes to minus theta. So, therefore, you would say, well, if I have a crystal that is breaks time reversal, then I will be inclined to write down such a term, because if the time reversal symmetry is broken, such term will be allowed. And then you may really be wondering why I'm giving this talk here, because after all, we're talking about the subject of a time reversal invariant topological insulator. So now let me make a small analogy. So suppose you were some being living in some one-dimensional space, a periodic ring in one dimension, and suppose there's a magnetic flux through your ring. So generically, magnetic flux is magnetic. Oh, so we should record the whole talk?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Start over.
Yeah.
Oh. Really?
No.
Huh?
No, they're supposed to be.
Oh, this is for posterity. It's important.
Oh.
Rewind.
Just rewind.
Really giving the...
Yeah, just go back.
Huh? No. Well, maybe I go through the few slides very quick. No. Okay. So now it's on? Okay. So now suppose you were some one-dimensional being living under a one-dimensional periodic system, such as a ring. And your ring is being threaded by some magnetic flux. Just by the argument I gave before, under the reversal of the arrow of time, magnetic field goes to negative of itself. So generically, if your ring is threaded by a magnetic flux, you will conclude that the time reversal symmetry is broken. But however, there are two special values of the flux measured in units of the flux quantum, namely whether the flux is either zero or pi, then your world is actually a time reversal invariant. Why? Because if you live in such a one-dimensional world, there's a periodicity of the flux mod 2 pi. If you shift the flux by 2 pi n, effectively you're just changing the boundary condition of going around or the barrier phase like this when you go around the ring. And if you change the flux by integer multiples of 2 pi n, then it is the boundary condition does not change, or the barrier phase it will change only by e to the I 2 pi n, and it will not change. So the physics is periodic if you live in such a under such a one-dimensional system under a shift of 2 pi. So now, generally, under time reversal, phi will go to minus phi. So therefore, something like pi will go to minus pi. But minus pi and pi are connected by 2 pi. And we just said physics is periodic under a shift of 2 pi. So therefore, you will conclude that for these two very special value of the flux, phi equals to 0 or phi equals to pi, the physics is time reversal invariant if you have a periodic one-dimensional system. Okay, so it turns out the same argument in its slight generalization applies to this so-called theta term. So first of all, the E dot B term is not a ordinary type of Landau-Ginzburg term that you write down. Usually the ordinary Landau-Ginzburg type of term you write down will have a bulk effect. But if you write E dot B, for example, in the relativistic notation, it's F mu nu times F mu nu dual. So if you take, for example, 0, 1, 2, 3, you get F 0, 1, which is E 1, and F 2, 3 times the epsilon symbol is the D, is B 1. So this is nothing but the scalar product of E dot B. But E dot B is a total derivative term. It's actually the derivative of the Chern-Simons term. Okay, so therefore, if you had a periodic system and integrated out this, it's just like this one-dimensional analog, that if you integrated E dot B, you get magnetic flux times the change of the magnetic flux. And by the famous Dirac quantization condition, we know that if you have a magnetic flux threading through a closed surface, it has to be integer multiples of phi zero.
Normally,
you require compactness of the gauge group, but
is given by pi 3, isn't it? Pi 3 of U1.
Yeah, that's for not meeting not meeting gauge U.
That's always given by pi 3.
So the,
it's always mapping, you know, at infinity. Those it's a map of a group.
Yeah.
Whatever gauge group.
Yeah.
Here you have U1. Three space onto the group. Now, why pi 3 of the group, which is non-trivial, labeled by n for non-abelian compact group? But U1?
Yeah, this this is just the Dirac.
Pi 3 of U1 is trivial.
You got it.
So what is... I mean, this term measures pi 3 of the group.
Only when you study a sphere.
I am on a sphere. I'm going to... Well, what do you want? So this is mapping of your mapping of the three torus times the line.
T4.
Time is imperiodic.
Yeah, we under the periodic condition of both space and time.
Yeah.
We will come to the situation of open boundary condition.
But there's a general way of doing it.
Right? Yeah.
And you agree that four. S3, it's trivial. Or if time wasn't periodic.
Right. You have to make time periodic. Yeah. So if you are given a model, you make space and time both periodic.
If it isn't periodic.
Right. So we will come back to it. So what happens for open system? And that's all the interesting physics that comes out. Right. So now, if you're given a model, you can first study the model under the condition of both periodic space and time.
Well,
and today we will see very soon what happens when you look at it in the open system.
And I could consider model where time isn't periodic.
Yeah, so let's first give the definition in this way. Okay? So then, under the periodicity of space and time, so then you get a, so it's an integer. So this gives you a definition. So the motivation, remember, is that if somebody gives me a model which contains disorder, contains interaction, I will first impose this boundary condition. And then I will try to integrate all the microscopic degree of freedom and ask myself what is the possible term you can get in the effective action. So then, in this case, under the periodic spatial and temporal boundary condition, you will get this is equals to integer multiples of the square of the flux point. So therefore, then its contribution to the partition function is always e to the I theta times n. So now if you shift theta by 2 pi n, the system, its contribution to the partition function will be periodic. And then you will conclude that there's two special values where the time reversal symmetry is recovered, either at theta equals to 0 or theta equals to pi. And we're very just one slide away from looking at what's its implications for the finite system. So now this gives you a general definition of the time reversal periodic. So any system that is any insulated model you care to give me, I put it under this boundary condition. I study, I integrate all the fermions. I ask myself, what is the effective action? Then there are only two possibilities, and that is a Z2 possibility. Either theta equals to 0, which we define to be a topologically trivial insulator, and theta equals to pi, which we define to be a topological non-trivial insulator. And the things discussed and which are now realized in realistic material is the new class, theta equals to pi, being the topological. This will be a boundary,
for systems which have time.
But this you can study it as a model system. So I give a general criteria. I will give you the criteria for open system.
But open systems don't have such a quantum number.
But you will see what theta means and what the non-periodicity of theta actually means. So now this is the concept of the time. The whole point of the talk is to explore all the microscopic connections and why in the periodic system, if you define these to be the two different classes, Z2 class of topological insulator under this boundary condition, why it's connected to everything, for example, what Charlie talked about. So this is the system of the quantum spin Hall effect. Charlie first discussed this in the context of graphene. And this paper, we actually independently proposed the quantum spin Hall effect, but for a system with lambda level. Actually, there's a very sharp distinction between these. These are actually two very different classes. Like the quantum Hall effect, we observe currently all with a magnetic translation group or under a magnetic field, whereas the quantum Hall effect that Charlie talked about have guided us very strongly conceptually, but there's actually no experimental observation yet of a quantum Hall effect that is kind of translationally without the magnetic translation group. So actually under this class, you can actually realize the fractional quantum spin Hall effect. And then we have the experimental theoretical prediction of realizing quantum spin Hall effect in the mercury territe system experiment by Lawrence Mollenkamp's group. Then the discussion about the helical edge state, the discussion of the three-dimensional topological insulator using the band definition. And this is the more general definition of the topological insulator in terms of the theta term. And the boundary condition is the essential thing.
Yes, I'm following you. Are you identifying this Z?
It's Z2. It's the same. Yeah. And that's the point of the talk. I'm going to explain.
His definition was for a system which was not periodic.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I first do it for periodic boundary condition. Time reversal invariance dictates only two possible values. And then the whole, what all the slides coming after, it's a non-trivial identification. Why this is exactly the same as the band definition of the Z2. Yeah.
Your space is three-dimensional in the previous discussion. So if time is periodic, you're talking about, homotopy classes and maps from the four torus to
Right.
Z2. That's correct.
But so we're going to consider the case. We're going to look at the case of open boundary condition. Then all the connection becomes very clear. But first, let me just so the theta term is a very, very important and powerful concept, and all the topological effect has been defined in terms of, so for example, the quantum spin chain allows such a theta term, and whether S is equal to integer or half integer is given by the theta term, whether it's integer is zero, half integer is pi, has direct experimental consequences. For half integer spin, it's gapless. For integer spin, it has a gap. The quantum Hall transition in some theoretical framework can be described by a theta term in a nonlinear sigma model, and it has a theta angle also equals to pi at the transition point. And then finally, there's the theta vacuum of the QCD. This is an effective term that's allowed by the theta vacuum, by the general symmetries of the QCD, and people have actually designed the experiment to detect what is the value of the theta. But just like David pointed out, the real system is not a system which satisfies these periodic boundary conditions. So we need to consider what is the theta term for a system of finite boundary, which is, after all, any piece of material that we will pick will be have a finite boundary. So then we use the identity that E dot B is nothing but the derivative of the transaminance term. Okay, so that tells you something very, very important. It tells you that if you have a piece of material, then E dot B is completely equivalent to a boundary term in the 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time. And that boundary term is a transaminance term. Okay, so this tells you that if you had such a topological term in a system with finite boundary, so then the boundary must have some quantum Hall effect. Okay, so now you can translate. You say, what is the theta equals to pi amounts to? Because we know the general theory of how quantum Hall effect is described by a transaminance term, we know that theta equals to pi describes exactly half of a quantum Hall conductance. Okay, so then this tells you that this must be a system. So now this term on a finite boundary breaks time reversal symmetry. Okay, because then you say, what exactly are you talking about? Sometimes it's time reversal symmetric, sometimes it's not. But this is actually only depends on the small time reversal symmetry.
Boundary in time.
Huh?
What about your boundary?
Yeah, boundary in time. Then you just says that in the 2 plus 1 dimension of space-time of the surface, the effective action is a transaminance term.
Now, the boundary in time is a different thing on the 3-dimensional.
Right. So, but this generally is true, right? So, this the boundary theory is then defined by a transaminance theory. So, transaminance theory describes the quantum Hall effect. So, this tells you that on the surface of this topological insulator, you are describing a quantum Hall effect, and when theta is equal to pi, it describes the half integer quantum Hall effect. So, now you say what exactly is going on? What's going on is that this procedure, let's now talk about open boundary system. This procedure of integrating out the fermions and getting effective action for the electromagnetic field is actually not so well defined when you have a topological insulator. Why? Because after all, the topological insulator, as you heard from Charlie's talk, is actually not an insulator. It is insulating in the bulk, but it actually is gapless on the surface. So in order to make this procedure well-defined, for a system which is completely periodic, then it has a full gap. But for a system that has a boundary, a topological insulator is not an insulator. So this procedure of integrating out fermions and get effective action when you have massless particles, you can generally get a complicated mass. So what you need to do is to apply a thin magnetic coating on the surface of a topological insulator. And that's the Zeeman field that Charlie was mentioning. So the effective action you get is independent of the magnitude, how strong a T-breaking field. It's very much like the definition of the symmetry breaking. It only depends on the sign of the magnetization. It's independent of the magnitude of the magnetization. And once you have a thin magnetic coating on the surface of a topological insulator, then it is actually an insulator.
Not necessarily, right?
There are two ways of gapping the topological insulator, but only one way to make it an insulator. If you made a superconducting gap, it's not an insulator. So if you really talk about...
That's not what I meant. What I meant is it's it could still be a metal after you put your thing back in.
If you have domain
walls. Yeah, if you have domain walls. So you have to consistent...
Even if you have the surface of bismuth antimony and you put a little thin magnetic...
Yeah. So, right? So you will choose it in such a way that you can... So you will make the surface by applying, may not be, but we will talk about a new material where this will be easy, okay?
So in the IT sense, it is an insulator. Because once you break T and once you have impurity, then it's always localized.
So now you were talking about a real piece of material with real boundary condition, and if you had a topological insulator, this procedure I proposed is ill-defined if you didn't do anything to the boundary, right? Because a topological insulator in an open system, when you strictly keep time reversal symmetry, is not an insulator. It conducts on the edge. Right. So in order to get a topological term or get a local electromagnetic response, you have to get an insulator first. Okay? So there's only one way. There are two ways to gap the gapless surface state. One by bring a superconductor on top, and the other is to bring a magnet on top. But there's only one way to make it insulating, because when you do a proximity with a superconductor, it's not an insulator. But remarkably, the physics is independent of the details that you apply this symmetry breaking term. Okay? So it always gives you a quantum Hall effect with half of Hall conductance, and that's exactly what the theta term equals to pi implies. Okay? So the boundary in this theory is the axion domain wall. Inside is theta equals to pi, outside is theta equals to zero. Now, when the theta angle rotates from pi to zero, you need to define exact sense how theta goes from pi to zero. And that is, when you go any value between, let's define a continuous interpolation between theta equals to pi and theta equals to zero, then you have to go through a value where theta is neither zero or pi. So you have to break T slightly on the boundary. When you break time reversal slightly on the boundary, it always leads to a quantum Hall effect with half of a Hall conductance, modulo an integer. Okay, so now the great consistent picture.
What happens to the boundary, the time derivative boundary?
Yeah, because then you have a two plus one dimensional transimous term.
You're discussing the spatial.
No, both the space and time. This is a space-time identity.
Gives you a time independent. Gives you an initial.
Right. So the transimous theory for quantum Hall effect is an action, both space and time.
But there's also an E, spatial E.
So you have to have the full transimous term to describe the quantum Hall effect.
I think, David, your question is that, so this is like spatial boundary. Can I have a time boundary?
Exactly.
Yeah, so time boundary is like the theta change in time.
So this, so if you have to do things in the time boundary.
But you're making some assumptions about that initial.
Yeah, so actually something very interesting happens when you make theta to be time dependent, and so it will lead to interesting pumping effect, which is... So basically in order to interpolate, there's two ways to interpolate theta equals to pi vacuum with theta equals to zero, either through a spatial domain wall or going through these temporary. And the temporal physics is extremely interesting, what leads to interesting pumping physics. Okay? But for now, it looks almost, now we see the great connection between these two approaches. Okay? So it tells you, because I didn't know exactly what Charlie is going to talk about, I was thinking about exactly the same introduction. The most important, one of the most important results from quantum field theory is that if you had a single Dirac cone, it will give you single Dirac cone, if you ask what is the Hall effect of a single Dirac cone, it's a little bit ill-defined. It's actually exactly in the boundary, it's schizophrenic. It doesn't know whether you want to be 1/2 E squared over H or minus 1/2 E squared. It depends on the small, of course, you know the famous result that if you integrate out the Dirac fermions for a massive Dirac model, you get 1/2 M over the absolute value of M E squared over H. So it does not depend on the magnitude of the small T breaking mass that you add, but in either way it will give you 1/2. Okay, so then we make a connection. So this is completely so far a bosonic field theory introducing on the basis of symmetry arguments, so on and so forth, but now we connect to the fermionic physics, because once you realize that the boundary term is a transimers term, and furthermore theta equals to pi implies 1/2 of a quantum Hall conductance, it has only a unique way to connect to fermionic physics because of the parity anomaly of the 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac fermion. And this is plotted experimentally when the people discovered quantum Hall effect in graphene. They of course know something about the background of Dirac fermion. They plotted the conductance, Hall conductance, in units of 4 E squared over H. And then you see that you develop plateaus exactly at half quantized value, except this is not a real number. The real number is 2, not 1/2. But this plot is supposed to tell you that the graphene has 4 Dirac points. And this experimental curve is telling you that each Dirac cone contributes to 1/2. Okay? So therefore, a theta vacuum of theta equals to pi, its boundary is a transimers term, and if theta is equals to pi, it can only come from one thing. It's coming from an odd number of Dirac cone on the surface. Okay? So that's the connection between the theta vacuum in the definition of the quantum field theory approach, topological field theory, and the fermionic physics and surface state. So there's only one way to connect the bosonic effective topological field theory to the fermionic surface state, right? So
let's me just a bosonic system. I mean, is it possible you have?
Yeah, but you cannot get theta equals to pi. So this you can absolutely prove. In a bosonic system, you have to have a system which has a time reversal symmetry with T squared equals to minus 1. That's an absolute necessary condition. So there's two ways to implement time reversal symmetry in quantum mechanics. One, in a bosonic system with T squared equals to 1. The other is a fermionic system with T squared equals to minus 1. One is called the orthogonal class, the other is the symplectic class. You can never get theta equals to pi from a orthogonal class. You can only get it from a symplectic class with fermions which are spin orbit coupled.
I'm confused. If I take a Fock space with a fixed even number of fermions, then T squared is equal to plus 1.
Yeah, I mean the underlying fermionic degree of freedom has to satisfy T squared equals to minus 1. The underlying model has to have fermions, which if you constructed a model with spin one fermion, this will not give you theta equals to pi. Yeah?
What's the value of your coefficient alpha?
Alpha is fine structure constant.
Okay.
Yeah?
So you said that you know, the theta value is identified with multiples of 2 pi,
yeah.
But when you actually physically do the
experiment. Yeah, that's the next slide. Okay, so for a periodic boundary condition, which is artificial, you give me a model, but I can do a theoretical calculation, right? I just applied it with the, that's my criteria, theoretically. Experimentally, I'm going to tell you that this tells you that there must be surface fermion living on the surface of this material. And that, in the bosonic language, have half quantum Hall effect described by the transimers term with half of a quantum of a conductance. And I will very soon come to define the equivalent class of different theta vacua in the next slide for open system. Right. So for the periodic system, I have this mathematical device, but it's a theoretical. Now let's talk about real experimental physics. So for a real system which has a boundary, then physics not periodic in theta. And so for generic for values for theta even equals to 2 pi or pi, it is not time reversal invariant. And that's consistent with everything I said, because in order to do this procedure at all, to ask myself what is the effective local electromagnetic response for this system.
It's not just the boundary, the spatial boundary.
it's also...
Yeah, yeah, so it will give you a lot of interesting things I'm going to tell you.
Periodic time, all your energy levels are quantum.
Yeah. So, yeah. But in the defining the, if you give me a model, I define it in the Euclidean sense, I can do this integral, I can ask myself the question. So we're just now trying to translate how the periodic, and this is one example, how the periodic periodicity in theta translates into the real system. So now you say, what exactly should, how should I interpret the periodicity in theta, and how should I interpret the non-time reversal symmetry of the theta equals to pi even. So we understand how do we interpret the fact that it's actually the system, for any open system, it breaks time reversal. And that's because it's absolutely necessary to have a time reversal breaking. It may not be sufficient, but it's necessary to introduce a T-breaking field to define my local electromagnetic response. Otherwise, I don't get an insulator. In order to talk about adiabatically integrating out microscopic degree of freedom, make my local effective action well-defined, I have to have a full gap, an insulating gap. And otherwise, if I put superconductivity on, I don't even know how to define A, right? So I have to get insulated. There's only one way to get insulated for time for bismuth antimony that we talk about. We have to apply a T-breaking field on the boundary. Okay. So that first tells us what the T-breaking for a periodic system. I said theta equals to pi is T-conserving. For open system, it's no longer T-conserving.
Charlie said first of all that even without violating T-invariance with some strong interactions.
You don't need to introduce a magnetic coding. You can make it.
You just said you had a breakdown.
Yes, spontaneously. Either explicitly or spontaneously.
You
only, it's a gap system, fermionically gap system. Either you break time reversal explicitly or through strong interaction, breaking it dynamically. There's no way, this is the topological insulator, strictly speaking, is not an insulator if it's purely time reversal invariant. So this is the thing which got us at least a little bit confused in the very beginning, right? Where after all, we're gathering here to talk about a time reversal invariant insulator. But the interesting thing is that we're only breaking the time reversal on the surface because this is where the gapless degree of freedom are. You can imagine that they open up a mini gap and they open up through the interaction, open the magnetic gap, which is much, much less than the bulk gap. So this is all surface physics.
Can I just make, you've been saying a few times that you need to have a gap on the surface to write down a to write down an effective electromagnetic theory.
Local.
Integrate out the Of course, we do this all the time in the 2D integer and fractional quantum Hall effect when there isn't a gap at the surface. It's still the Chern-Simons theory works. In fact, it describes the edge states at the surface. It seems like that's too strong a condition. I mean, you're writing down a term which is an integral of some local density, and so that. Some sense.
I mean, what goes wrong if you have massless degrees of freedom is not you can't integrate
a module. No, but you get non-local. Yeah, but I want to say you cannot possibly get some.
It's a similar thing. It's in quantum Hall, you integrate out the bulk and you get the transamers. And then when you consider the transamers on the open boundary, then if you you want to write down the quantum Hall effective theory for an open boundary system, then you have transamers coupled to the edge theory.
Right.
And here, you write down the bulk theory as the wedge. And then if you want to write down the bulk theory with the open boundary without breaking T, then it's F wedge coupled to some gapless Fermi. But the easiest way to see what's the effect of that, the gapless Fermi, is you break T on the boundary, and then you get the transamers on the boundary.
Yeah, so this is all parity anomaly physics because the theta equals to pi is exactly the result by integrating out the odd number of massless Dirac fermions on the boundary when you put a very small T-breaking field. Okay, so now first thing is we interpret it. What does T-breaking mean? Because the effective action when you write down E dot B, you say, we're here to talk about time reversal invariant insulator, then you write down T dot B, it breaks time reversal. I hope I explain everything carefully, okay? So E dot B, if you introduce a boundary condition which is periodic both in space and time, it is the system is fully gapped, and you can integrate everything out. You get E dot B with theta equals to pi. It does not break time reversal symmetry. When you have an open boundary system, then you, in order to make the at least in this narrow definition, to make the effective electromagnetic effective action local effective action well defined, you introduce a T-breaking field either spontaneously or dynamically. Okay, so once you have T broken, then the massless fermions become a gap, and they can contribute a whole conductance either 1/2 or minus 1/2. And because you have odd number of them, no matter how you add up, you always end up with pi.
So when the dimension, spatial dimension is 4, then you can simply integrate. Because you are free from that particular one.
But I'm saying the parity anomaly on the surface, which is 2 plus 1 dimension. That's why our number of Dirac fermion will always give you pi. So now we see the important connection between the Z2, right? So Z2 counts whether you have our number of Dirac cones on the surface or not, and that exactly is related to whether theta equals to pi or 0 modulo 2 pi. But then there's another puzzle, because the other puzzle is that in the system with the periodic identification, I had a theta periodicity. Shifting theta by 2 pi literally means the same thing. But for any open system, this periodicity argument is no longer true. Because, for example, if I had theta equals to 2 pi, I will have integer quantum Hall effect n equals to 1 on the surface, and you will say this is different from n equals to 0. Okay? So what do I mean exactly for open system, the periodicity by theta? So I define this by an equivalent class. Okay, so I say all the integer quantum Hall plateaus, they can be connected to each other by varying T invariant disorder potential. Because the plateau transition tells me a selection rule of delta n equals to 1. So n equals to 0 can make a transition to n equals to 1 without doing anything with time reversal breaking field by just changing the disorder potential. This is the famous plateau transition quantum Hall effect. Once I'm at n equals to 1, I can go to n equals to 2. I can go to n equals to minus 27 and so on and so forth. But the selection rule of the integer quantum Hall transition delta n equals to 1 tells me there's no way to connect half quantum Hall conductance with integer quantum Hall conductance. Because that's it. So therefore, in an open boundary system, there's no, strictly speaking, a periodicity in theta. But you can define something that's equivalent to it, well, in spirit. Namely, you can define a equivalence classes of all states which can be connected to each other by a T-invariant potential. Because we know if I have a model of quantum Hall effect, I make the disorder very, very large, I know quantum Hall effect will disappear. N equals to 1 can make a transition into N equals to 0. But this tells you about something very, very exciting. It tells you that we have in condensed matter system another dissipationless system. Because N equals to 1/2, or sigma equals to 1/2, no matter how strong a disorder potential you put, you can only get to N equals to minus 1/2. You can never get to n equals to 0, unless you do violence to the bulk. But by the rules of the topology, we're saying you can only do things on the surface. You cannot close the bulk gap or anything like that. Okay. So therefore, in the open system, we define two general equivalence classes. It's all the states that can be connected to each other through the integer quantum Hall plateau transition are defined to be one class. And then there's only one another class, and that's the half-integer class. So half-integer class, you can jump from 1/2 to 3/2 to 5/2 to minus 1/2, but it's not possible to make a transition to 0 without doing things to the bulk. Okay, so that is the sense in an open system, you can define something like the theta periodicity in this generalized sense of the equivalence class. And the robustness of the topological surface state is really due to the no-go theorem. Okay, and it's a very strong experimentally important theorem. So we, in high energy physics, in quantum field theory and lattice gauge theory, we know the Nielsen-Enomia theorem, which tells you that it's almost impossible to construct chiral fermion. And one of the most interesting idea is to construct fermion, chiral fermion, as the boundary of something. Okay. So we actually have proven, maybe other people know about it, but this is the, I think, the place we can, only we can find it, is that even though there's even a similar theorem for Dirac fermion, okay? But only when there's a T squared equals to minus 1 symmetry. Okay, so then you cannot have odd number of Dirac fermions. So that tells you that theta equals to pi, the boundary of a theta equals to pi insulator, has to be a holographic liquid. The liquid cannot exist by itself. You can never construct a two-dimensional liquid which has these half-Hopf quantum Hopf conductors. It can only exist as the boundary of something. Okay? And that tells you this is not just some abstract theorem. It tells you why this thing is useful. Because imagine you put rust. You take a surface. The surface scientists worry about this thing all the time. If I had a nice surface, what happened if I exposed to air for 5 hours? Right? By the virtue of this theorem, it tells you that all ordinary two-dimensional matter, maybe a thin layer of oxide is two-dimensional, can only have an even number of Dirac cones. So if you put any ordinary states of matter on top of that surface, then you can annihilate only one pair of them, and you still have one left. Okay? And so that tells you that it's very robust against surface reconstruction, surface chemistry, and so on. Right. So let me just finish. In particular, for example, and this is defines another equivalent class. The robustness defines another way to define the equivalence class. Suppose you had theta equals to 4 pi. Then you had 4 Dirac cones. Yeah. Then it's a very simple thing to do. You just deposited a graphene film on top of it. Because graphene has 4 Dirac cones. If your surface also has 4 Dirac cones, they will mutually annihilate and gap out the whole system. You apply a time reversal invariant perturbation and you destroy the surface. So theta equals to 4 pi is trivial in that sense. But theta equals to pi, there's nothing you can do to the surface to make it disappear. And that's the tremendous robustness of that. Yeah?
So in the case of graphene, there are 4 Dirac cones at the bottom.
Yeah.
So what you're saying?
No. It's a two-dimensional film, right?
Yeah.
Now my surface is also two-dimensional. If I had a theory integrated out, I get for open boundary system theta equals to 4 pi. Then it tells me I have a three-dimensional material whose two-dimensional surface has 4 Dirac cones. Now I put a graphene film on top of it. I have 4 and 4, and they can open up a gap. So the surface state disappears.
But you can't do it locally, but you can take another sphere.
So then this really tells you, in order to really understand the global topology of the topological insulator, now we really have a starting point. The starting point is the theta FF wedge dual. Right. So then you immediately know what is its topological property on a non-trivial manifold. You don't need to solve the complicated electronic structure on this non-trivial manifold. You just say what is theta FF dual on this surface. So now this in particular leads to the topological magnetoelectric effect. And that's the magnetoelectric effect I introduced on the first slide. And this is exactly what the high-energy physicists have studied with the axion dynamics, okay? So this theta angle, when it's a fixed number, it is the theta angle. When it's a dynamical field, it's called an axion. And you can view the boundary of the topological insulator to vacuum as the axion domain wall. Inside the boundary, you have theta equals to pi. Outside of the boundary, you have theta equals to zero. But if you insist on a continuous interpolation of theta equals to pi to theta equals to zero, you have to break time reversal on the boundary. And that is what gives rise to the surface topological magnetoelectric effect. So, and that's defined by this set of equation. Because it's a total derivative, you can make it disappear from the Maxwell's equation, but you have to do something, namely you have to change the underlying constituent equation. You can also, of course, rewrite this into the Maxwell equation and start with the ordinary constituent equation. So now this quantity, theta equals to pi, the more rigorous definition is called the electromagnetic polarization. And theta equals to, so for the non-trivial insulator, it's theta equals to pi, but there's a more general definition. So if you give me a band structure, I can compute, and that so this is another reason why this thing can only happen when you have fermionic degree of freedom with T squared equals to minus 1, because you need to construct a non-abelian Barry's curvature. And when you integrate that, you can get theta equals to P3. And P3 itself, for time reversal invariant system, can be 0 or 1/2. But the more interesting topological statement about P3, which is a three-dimensional quantity, is that if you integrated P3 along some adiabatic path, you will get that the change of P3 is exactly the second trend number.
I'm confused as to why you have
an alpha. Alpha is the fine structure.
Yeah, but why you have an alpha?
Because you usually take h bar equals to c equals to 1. If you didn't.
What is alpha? 1 over 137.
Yeah, 1 over 137.
Your unit? No.
Yeah, so I'm written everything in the CGS units. So the relationship between.
Still don't get it. Your definition of the beta term involved in alpha.
Yeah, because the quantization of this E dot B in this periodic boundary condition involving phi squared in physical unit. No, but phi squared, I say theta shifting by theta equals to 2 pi, you need to add some number to make it dimensionless, right? But the quantization of E dot B is n times phi squared, h bar c over E squared.
And theta equals pi, 2 pi here.
Yeah.
P3 is 1, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird to have an alpha there.
Yeah, there is an alpha. Yeah. So in the physical units, I take CGS units and. So another way to explain is very, very simple. Because when Klaus von Klitzing wrote the first integer quantum Hall effect paper, he actually said this is a measurement of alpha, which is not true because it's E squared over H. There's a C missing. Now, where did the C come from? The C comes from the following effect, that you apply an electric field. Now, there's a surface quantum Hall effect with half of a quantum Hall conductance. So then there's a current. So the relationship between E and J has E squared over H in it. That's the quantum Hall effect. But J induces a magnetic field. So by Maxwell equation, it has a C. So it's exactly alpha. So this, I think, is a physical explanation, right? So the reason you get this magnetoelectric effect is that you apply an electric field, right? Now the surface, after you put down this magnetic coating, will have a quantum Hall effect on the boundary, okay? So the moment I apply electric field, I get this current to flow. Now, what's the amount of the current? It's 1/2 E squared over H times E. Now, the current, by Maxwell equation, the Ampere's term, has a C in it. So the current induces a magnetic field, so you are combining E squared H from the Hall conductance with a C from the Maxwell's equation. So it has the alpha in it. So that's the most direct physical explanation. Okay? So now it leads to some very interesting effects. As I said, the theta vacuum was first talked about in the context of quantum field theory, the theta vacuum of QCD. And then Witten wrote a very interesting paper, which says that you can kind of guess it, right? If this E dot B, then electric things look magnetic and magnetic things look electric. So in particular, you will predict the following effect, that if you have a topological insulator and you had a surface of the topological insulator, and I have to do this thing to make it really an insulator, namely by putting a thin magnetic coating on top of the surface. So then when I put an electric charge on top of that surface, now usually Jackson teaches if you put an electric charge, you will get an image charge below the surface. As far as all the measurement above the surface is concerned. Now, when you put an electric charge, you will get image magnetic monopole below the surface. Now, what's the physical reason? You will get a monopole. Monopole will also have a charge. You will get a dyne, right. So because there's also the Jackson effect, because the electric charge will induce an ordinary image charge, but then it will have a magnetic charge. So you put a charge here, you will get a dyne. Okay? And the physical reason is the following. Because now I really have an insulator. If I didn't put a magnetic coating, this effect will not be there. Because then the electric field lines will be entering the surface normally. Right? Because if there's a tangential component, you can get charge to move. So you have to impose that boundary condition. But now I have applied a thin magnetic coating on top of the surface. It's completely insulating. It's gapped. Now, it may not be easy to do, but suppose we have done that. And I will show you. It will be done. So then you will get half quantum Hall effect on the surface. Now, what does it mean? You take a top-down picture. You look at your image charge. Then it's allowed to have an in-plane component of the electric field because it's an insulator. But the surface has dissipationless current, indestructible dissipationless current. No matter how strong amount of disorder you put on the surface, it has to conduct. So it has to have these currents to flow. And these currents will induce a magnetic field, which viewed from the upper surface looks like exactly like that of a magnetic monopole below the surface. So the monopole effect of the theta vacuum can be experimentally measured.
So is it going to be quantized?
No. So because the other monopole, because the surface is still, if you had a closed surface, the other monopole would be very, very far on the close to the other side of the surface. So it's measuring the monopole in the same sense as you measure things like fractionalization in condensed matter, in the sense that they can be arbitrarily far separated. The strength of the monopole is alpha times Q, this fine structure constant times Q.
It's one times alpha.
Is
the size of the magnitude of the magnetic monopole,
yeah,
is that precisely...
That has a dielectrical correction. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's suppose you had a trivial insulator,
yeah,
and happened to have a nuclear one.
Right. So you have to determine it from the magnitude of the effect.
But the magnitude is
either one or one half. Once you gap this.
Non-universal number.
Oh, right. You mean epsilon conspire in such a way that it give you...
So I'm just asking whether
epsilon, yeah. That's, in practice, I think you can tell because a lot of conspiracy has to, what the material is. And this is the experiment. So if you have a charge on top of the surface and you have a magnetic tip, which we can build a magnetic field tomorrow, we will hear from Ken Muller.
Alpha is what? The
1 over 37.
In the vacuum.
This is the vacuum formula. There's some epsilon corrections to it for the material. Yeah. And P3 is 1 half.
So you'd have to measure it independently, alpha.
Alpha you just take to be 1 over 37. The only other thing that comes in is the epsilon and mu of the material, which you know very well. Okay? So therefore, now you put a charge here and you build a sensitive magnetic tip, and then you measure the magnetic field as a function of distance. And you will find a 1 over d squared law. An experimentalist will interpret a 1 over d squared law of the magnetic field and he or she can cover the entire hemisphere, and then they can know that it's as if it's coming from one point source. And it depends, the magnetic field depends on the distance with 1 over d squared. And he will plot magnetic field, he or she, plot the magnetic field as a function of the distance d squared, and the coefficient, he will take it to be the operational definition of the magnetic monopole charge. And they can check this formula. Okay? And the numbers are all reasonable. So yeah, this is a very reasonable electric field that you can apply on the surface, and it will generate a magnetic field of the order of a Gauss, which the Earth's magnetic field is of the order of a Gauss. So when the compass can detect the Earth's magnetic field, right? So now, theta over 2 pi, and it's 1 half for topological insulator. Yeah. So now, in condensed matter physics, over the past 20 years or so, we have repeatedly talking about a theoretical device. And we say, wouldn't it be interesting if we can attach some fictitious flux to the electron and transmute it to a boson, to an anion, or anything we want? But we don't know how to really attach a fictitious magnetic flux. But this image monopole effect is a beautiful experimental implementation of it. Because you put a charge, it induces a monopole, and the monopole always follows wherever the charge goes, because after all, this is an image. Now, if you have another charge, it will also have a monopole. Now, when you interchange the two of them, you will just get this upper hemisphere. So the flux that is seen, or the Born-Hodgkin phase factor, is exactly the line integral. But if you move both trajectories very close to on the 2D surface, you always take the flux of 2 pi, which is the solid angle of the upper hemisphere. So independent of the path of the exchange, you will get a fraction of statistics angle. And the monopole is like the fictitious flux that's being attached to the electron and follows wherever the electron goes.
But you don't, the mono, that's a dion there.
Yeah. So the dion is exactly what gives rise to the transmutation. So the charge sees the monopole, the charge sees that monopole.
But the fraction's not quantized, right?
No, the fraction, the NE2D is allowed not to be quantized. Unfortunately, the angle is rather small. So it is electrons are fermions. These two particles will deviate from fermionic behavior with the statistical angle which is proportional to alpha squared, 10 to the minus 4. And that's the unfortunate small. Oh, alpha being small helped us a lot in QED, but now we also have to live with alpha that's 1 over 37 squared.
This is the
electron. The Born-Hodgkin phase, the statistical angle.
Right, but it's the statistical angle for there's an electron above and there's a dion below.
Yeah, but that's a higher order effect.
Yeah.
This
object.
Yeah, for this object.
It's an electron plus dion.
Yeah, right.
The dion itself has a charge, I think, also alpha squared times E.
Yeah.
But that doesn't cancel the set, right?
No. So we know, for example, there are examples in field theory. Oh, actually, Tony Z is one of the early ones who did that, right? The statistical transmutation of the dion. But that's in three dimension. And when you did everything correctly in three dimension, you can only go from boson to fermion, not other way around. And here the argument crucially depends that you are on the surface of 2D. And then you can get fractional statistics. So now you can measure this experimentally, because if you put an island and you like a quantum dot, by the gate voltage, you can change the amount of charge on the island. But every charge has a monopole, and every other charge that go around the loop will see the monopole, and you will see that the angle of the Born-Hodgkin flux is directly related to V by this angle.
Could this happen just in the integer quantum Hall effect? I mean, just nu equals 1, something similar? I mean, isn't it?
Yeah.
The same, isn't it? So
yeah.
Bring a
yeah, so I think this thing is special because one is that it's a closed surface, and the other is that this is an indestructible effect. That no matter how dirty the surface is, it has to happen. Because 1/2 can only go to minus 1/2. Actually, Charlie was mentioning what are the interesting things to study. So we studied a lot about integer quantum Hall transitions. So maybe someday we should study what's the 1/2 to minus 1/2 transition, which is one possibility. So we will have a session on disorder effects. Shensei Liu, Akira Furusaki, they have really, and Donna Shen, they really have studied disorder. Well, but some of the disorder effects on the surface, and when you formulate it into the quantum Hall context, it's a very sharp statement that the transition, you can make make the surface as dirty as you want, but always have an indestructible dissipationless current on the surface.
So a related question to Matthew, I guess. I mean, any magnetoelectric material then also could do this with the principle?
Yeah, but the usual magnetoelectric material are not defined by E dot B, by something more complicated.
Yeah, so in general, there's some tensor.
Yeah, but then they also contain derivative.
I would expect there's always a diagonal component, right?
But usually, sometimes it's traceless diagonal component. So it would be interesting enough to look at other material. But they also break time reversal in the bulk. That, I think, is the catch.
Yeah, they break time.
Yeah, so here the time reversal is now broke.
This game, do you care?
Yeah, but I think the indestructibility of the surface state has to do with the fact that the bulk is time reversal invariant. So now we also mentioned that you can do the Faraday angle rotation because there's a surface quantum Hall effect, and the Faraday rotation angle is given in its organ. So angle is a dimensionless number, and the rotation angle is tangent of that is 1 over 137. And that may be the easiest way to monitor the transition. And this is the angle is like Aaron Kapitonik can do 10 to the minus 8 radian. So now let me tell you a little bit about the theoretical physics connection. So after all, this topological insulator sounds very similar to an attempt to generalize a quantum Hall effect. And actually, we actually made the early attempt, because that's perhaps what anyone would do if you're motivated by field theory, if you don't care about dimensions in particular. Right? You say quantum Hall effect is described by the transimons term in 2 plus 1 dimension. If you want to generalize quantum Hall effect, you can natural dimension you go to is not 3 plus 1, but 4 plus 1. And indeed, Jiangping Hu and I have constructed a microscopic model of quantum Hall effect, but in the 4 plus 1 dimension. Now, that was, of course, a little bit disappointing that you had to go to 4 dimension. But now we understand the precise connection between these 4 plus 1 dimension of quantum Hall effect and the topological insulator through the theta connection. Because if you describe the four-dimensional quantum Hall effect, it will be described by the 4 plus 1 dimensional transimons term. How do you go to 3 plus 1 dimension? We, of course, have learned there's a procedure of compactifying the small extra dimension. So if you have the small extra dimension, let's call it the X5, the extra dimension, or maybe we should call it the X4, then this is your compactified dimension, and you only live on the three-dimensional space. But through the extra dimension, it's compactifying to a little circle, you can exert a flux. And you can exert a flux either 0 or pi to get time reversal symmetry. So this very example that I gave as a tutorial pedagogical example of threading a flux through a ring, and the flux is either 0 or pi to recover time reversal symmetry, is actually can be done, except that the flux, the theta angle equals to pi, this actually is the flux through the little extra compact dimension. Okay, so somebody threaded a little pi flux, and that's why we have topological insulators. So, and this is the precise connection between the four-dimensional quantum Hall effect and the three-dimensional topological insulator, and for one very special value of theta, you will get theta equals to pi, which is time reversal invariant. And when we constructed this class, the Kramer's pair played an absolutely essential role. And that, again, shows that everything is very consistent. You have to get a non-abelian gauge field, but because of the Kramer's doublets, you will get naturally a non-abelian field. Now, well, this may be of some academic interest to know that some 3D topological insulator is derivable from a higher dimensional topological insulator. But at this point, you may ask the question, if the theta angle action is the effective theory for the 3D topological insulator, what's the effective action for the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall state? Now you can follow the recipe and do the dimensional reduction again. So you have the effective action for the 3 plus 1 dimensional system, and let me make the theta an axion field rather than theta being only a parameter which defines theta equals to pi, the topological insulator. Let me make theta to be a general parameter. You will see the general reasoning why this is useful to do. And for you, you can just say that if you are not, you don't care about anything else, the only thing you need to remember is that theta can both have a time dependence and the space dependence, or the interesting effect David talks about can be studied in this effective action. And when you look at the boundary of the topological insulator, it's nothing but a gradient of theta going from pi to zero outside. Okay, so now if I do a partial integration with f mu dual, then one of the derivatives will act on theta. So then I have a free A, gradient of theta, gradient of A. So now I decompose my dimension into the two-dimensional space and the extra dimension, which is Z. And now I have A along the extra dimension Z. I curl that up, I will get the flux through the extra dimension, which I call phi. Then I get a two-dimensional effective action. Okay? So once you have a two-dimensional effective action and you see A enters linearly, and then you can immediately derive what is the induced electromagnetic current, and it's given by this formula for two-dimensional case. So theta equal to pi inside and theta equals to zero outside, but phi is a more interesting thing. It's exactly a similar magnetic field that you apply to the boundary of the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect. Again, we follow the same philosophy. Two-dimensional quantum spin Hall effect is not exactly insulated either. It has gapless edge state. So in order to make it perfectly well-defined, we apply some magnetic field or some magnetic impurities. We're asking Lawrence to do that through doping mercury terride by manganese. This is the manganese field. Okay? So now, when you look at the edge of the one-dimensional system, you will find the current is exactly given by this formula, and that's the celebrated Goldstone-Wellcheck formula for the solid tonic current. And you will see there's a physical effect which is can be used to define the Z2, physically measure the Z2 quantum number. So this is what I would introduce about the quantum spin Hall effect. Charlie, basically repeating what Charlie said, and so you have the one-dimensional, you have the, generally if you're living in one dimension, if you take spinless fermion, you have two chiral modes. What quantum Hall effect is doing is to say 2 equals to 1 plus 1. One chiral mode on the upper edge, the other chiral mode on the lower edge. Now, and there's a no-go theorem, and that's really Niels and Enomia, which says that the chiral fermion cannot exist purely in one dimension. It can only exist in the holographic sense, that it's only the boundary of a two-dimensional system. Now, you have quantum spin Hall effect, and the generalization is almost obvious in retrospect. Instead of writing 2 equals to 1 plus 1, you write 4 equals to 2 plus 2. So if you have a spin-full one-dimensional liquid, you have 4 degrees of freedom, you decompose them into two time-reversal pairs. And we have a theorem which says that if you try to do a one-dimensional model with t squared equals to minus one time reversal symmetry, you can never construct only one single Kronecker pair. You have to have the doubling. So the quantum spin Hall effect, the essential feature is that the 4 degree of freedom of a spin-full t squared equals to minus one fermionic system, four channels, has been decomposed into its most elementary form, namely one Kronecker pair. So now, all this mathematical dimensional reduction, what does it tell you? It tells you that you will have a solid tongue with fractional charge E over 2 on the edge of the on the edge state of the quantum Hall effect. So now, what? And this is exactly the content of this formula. And what it is saying is that you already did 4 equals to 2 plus 2, so you have one minimal set. So you one Dirac fermion in one dimension. Okay, so most models like the polyacetylene will have two Dirac modes in one dimension. So this is already very special. And you can see why this is very special, because this is gapless, but you can introduce a gap by putting a magnetic doping onto the boundary. So once you put magnetic doping, time reversal symmetry is broken, a gap is opened up. So all the interesting theta physics I was talking to you about earlier should be repeated here. Now here, one interesting thing you can do is you twist the magnetization by pi. Okay? So if you twist magnetization by pi, then you induce a soliton, and that soliton will have E over 2. Okay? Now, you say, oh, this sounds very familiar. Isn't that exactly what Sushi-Rieffer-Heger predicted for polyacetylene? Except Sushi-Rieffer-Heger predicted not E over 2 because of the doubling. There's a charged soliton. You have E over 2 for spin up, E over 2 for spin down. Net together, you don't get fractional charge for polyacetylene with dimerization. But here, you really have fractional charge. Why? Because you already fractionalized once. You already wrote 4 equals to 2 plus 2. And therefore, when you made a domain wall, it will exactly give you E over 2. And that's an example of electromagnetic duality in one dimension. Why? Because this tells you that a magnetic soliton induces electric charge. The most elementary magnetic soliton is a pi soliton, and the most elementary charge in this case gives you E over 2. So it's some magnetic thing giving you some electric thing. that's in essence some quantized nature of the quantum spin Hall effect, that a pi soliton will give you charge E over 2. And that you can detect experimentally. Okay, so you can put some magnetization, define an island, and you can measure the Coulomb blockade pattern. Now, if you reverse the arrow of one of the domain, then on this island, you will trap charge E over 2. And when you measure the Coulomb blockade pattern, it will shift by half a period, because each period is E, and half a period is E over 2. So fractional charge is one, and this is a Z2 measurement, right? Because if you wrote, you can define domain wall with 2 pi, then you will get the integer. So measuring charge in the half units defines the Z2-ness. So that basically concludes my introduction to the theta physics. And what follows is some microscopic discussion. Should I go on, or should we discuss? Okay. Okay. So, so Charlie, of course, gave a pretty quick introduction to our.
One thing we could do is break and give people a chance for cookies, because it is the IGP cookie time.
Okay.
And say that you come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just to make it interesting, there's a prediction of a room temperature topological incident.
Want
to come in with
just one channel,
and
the other one, a couple, and then
your lecture. Yeah. So maybe
first turn it off so that.
Now you want it to be a, this will be an empty state in the same channel, so its magnetic moment be down. It will be an empty missing spin up electron down the moment. So this process here is not observed.
Yeah,
because there's always this confusion. What do we call this empty state? We call this spin up.
If I apply a voltage between these two, so that the Cooper pair from the semiconductor tunnels into the edge, the Cooper pair, one has spin up, one has spin down. It seems to me then it's possible
this is a way to think of it, which is highly misleading, because you have to somehow. So this is true. If you think of it in this way, in fact, you will never understand how you could ever how you could ever have Andreev. Suppose you take this S, right? Here I right. come in. Okay. Impossible. Right. There's no way in which you can inject. In fact, let me tell you. Duncan Haldane was in Leiden. He was Lawrence professor.
Yes.
He said, Andreev reflection from a topological insulator is impossible. And it was his argument. He said, look, try to inject a Cooper pair. Spin up, spin down. But they cannot move in the same direction. So he thought that superconductivity would be completely suppressed. So the reason is that this way of thinking is probably can be reconciled, but you have to redefine your ground state. So the only proper way to figure this out without making errors is to think of it as a process. Something comes in, something comes out. And now you have no difficulties at all. For example, in this case here, I would say electron.
In this case, electron in
the spin up band comes in. Hole in the spin down band comes out. So a hole in the spin down channel has the same magnetic moment as the electron in the spin up channel.
That's right. That makes sense.
But if you think of it as injecting two electrons with opposite spin, it's not possible because you cannot inject two electrons with opposite spin because the helical channels will.
Not in this case, but you're right. I mean, if the superconductor.
So let's just not to confuse the thing. I mean, we can think of it later in other ways. So the way I would like you to. I would like to explain this process to you is in terms of Andreev reflection. So something comes in, something comes out. So here's my statement. If you have coupled this weakly, however you do it, without breaking down resonance symmetry, so no magnets. Magnets is the thing I analyzed. Then electron will come in. It will see the superconductor. It can either continue.
Is it continue?
If you want to transform it into a hole, it has to go back. Because if it continues as a hole, or it will remain in the same helical, the same the same single helical edge channel,
right.
It will be an empty state in the spin up, so the spin will have flipped. The magnetic moment will have flipped.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'll sit down and think about it. The naive way I would think, is to think about a Cooper. So you want to inject?
Yeah. I would recommend not to do that. I'm sure there is a way somehow to reconcile everything, but you will not be able to make progress if you think of it in this way.
Okay, yeah, I'll sit down and think about it.
So, you know, I like to describe what we did as a splitting of a Cooper pair, but that's just for an audience. If I want to present it in a simple way, right? The only way I can solve this problem without making errors is by looking at the excitations.
Right.
And so then the condensate, the Cooper pairs, are not there; they're gone.
Right.
I think of it as excitation, so I just have an initial state and a final state.
I agree.
And the magnetic moment of the final state has to be the same as the magnetic moment of the Cooper state.
Basically, you want to the BDG equation applies to
normal, excitations.
It applies to normal excitations.
That's right. If you want to put the ground, the condensate into the bookkeeping,
okay,
I'm sure it's possible. It's difficult.
I understand.
To the extent that, you know, of course, Haldane is a giant. I'm not a giant. Still, I was able to just tell him, look, I'm sorry, you're wrong. He came and said, it's absolutely impossible. Here you can see, try and inject a Cooper pair. The edge channels don't allow you to inject spin up and spin down moving in the same direction. And I could not really say why this was wrong, but I knew that this way of reasoning is very tricky. Whereas the other way of reasoning is always correct, because you can never make errors there, because the condensate somehow is
condensate states
which go down to minus infinity. I don't know how to do this bookkeeping.
Exactly.
I just have the excitation, then the bookkeeping is trivial.
Okay, I see. Yeah. Okay. Let me think about it.
Yeah. Sure.
That is something.
higher than
not for you, I guess.
Exactly.
you study some localization thing, right?
Oh, disorder. Yeah, disorder system. Yeah. It turns out, yeah, in that gene.
Well, I don't know why.
It didn't really help us out.
Oh, I see.
Very nice.
Can you bring time also?
So you consider
this pool?
When you have the
Can you tune it to zero?
Yes, if I tune it to zero, then...
Well, I don't see it in the book, then I can
see that in the relative
sense. Right.
Well, yeah, here we go. Even in the bulk of... Right. Here, there's not prints it up. Yeah.
Okay. So now we would like to talk about the microscopics, what kind of material which could lead to that. And so we came across with mercury terrarite through, well, originally guided by some, actually knowing a little bit about quantum field theory and knowing the results about the parity anomaly was actually very, very helpful to come across this material. But then at various spintronic conferences, Lawrence Mollenkopf and I started talking and learned a lot more about this material. But in the end, I think why mercury terrarite is a quantum spin Hall effect becomes a very, very simple story, which I think everyone can understand. So the bulk electronic structure of most semiconductors is very, very easy to understand, at least for things like gallium arsenide and cadmium terrarite. So in atomic physics, we learned that there's the S level and then there's the P level. But then a little bit later, we learned under spin orbit coupling, P level was split into P3 half and P1 half. And then there's a S level here. So now what happens that if you put all these atoms into a solid, all what's happening is the S level broadens into a band and the P3 half level broadens into a band and P1 half broadens into a band. That's the only thing you need to know about semiconductor electronic structure. So when the S level broadens into a band, it's called gamma 6 because in a solid you don't really have spherical symmetry, but only some lattice discrete symmetry, and this lattice group and the classification is gamma 6. And then when the P3 half level broadens up, it gives you the so-called gamma 8, and that's the light hole and the heavy hole. And it's very, very important that the spin orbit coupling is present in the light hole and heavy hole because of the P3 half. And the splitting between P3 half and P1 half basically is the realistic measurement of the of how strong spin orbit coupling is in real material. So most materials such as gallium arsenide, cadmium terrarite all follow this type of band diagram. But when you come to mercury terrarite, a very strange thing happens because we know from basic atomic physics that the spin orbit coupling strength scales with the atomic number. The lower you go into the periodic table, the heavier the elements are, the larger the spin orbit coupling. So in mercury terrarite, the spin orbit coupling for the P level is so large that it overwhelms the original level difference between S and P. And the splitting of P3 half is so large that it jumps over the S level, and the 1 half level is below. And so you get this type of level ordering, and that's why it is sometimes called the inverted band gap material. But the tremendous simplicity is that all these things are happening at the gamma point, or k equals to 0 point. So it's very easy to keep track of. So now that gives you some wonderful tuning knobs to tune the band structure. And namely, because these two materials, cadmium terrarite, which has the ordinary band structure, and the mercury terrarite, which has the opposite band structure when P and S level are interchanged, it leads to very interesting possibilities of engineering the quantum wells. So if you have the mercury terrarite quantum well in between cadmium terrarite, so when the limit when mercury terrarite is very thin, then you can just say, oh, then it's basically its band character are inherited mostly from those of the cadmium terrarite, right? At least in the limit mercury terrarite is one atomic layer, you will say basically it's all cadmium terrarite. So then you will expect S level to be above the P level, Okay? But then when mercury telluride gets thick, then we know in the bulk mercury telluride, the P level lies above the S level. So you will get the opposite band ordering. So somewhere a transition has to happen. And that is happening around 6 nanometer in quantum well width. So now why is this an interesting transition? Because the effective model describing the mercury telluride is a Dirac model. So let me try to explain to you why this is the case. So we can take a very, very simple model of 4 orbitals per atomic site. So you have the S orbital spin up, S orbital spin down. But then you need to look at the P orbital. What are the P orbitals? Because there are 3 P orbitals. It turns out that you're looking at the heavy hole. So what does it mean by heavy hole? The heavy hole means the strongest spin orbit coupled orbitals. So if it has spin up, you take the Px plus Ipy orbital. If you are spin down, you take the Px minus Ipy orbital. So altogether, these are the 4 levels you need to consider. And you only need to consider things very close to the gamma point because that's when the inversion happens. So now let's try to write down an effective model for these 4x4 atomic orbitals and so from general symmetry considerations, how they can couple to each other. So let's, to the lowest order, we only consider the upspin blocks. Now if you, and then the matrix fall into the double diagonal, the block diagonal form. But that does not mean that you're neglecting spin orbit coupling. Actually, spin orbit coupling is playing a very, very important role in the sense you're taking the heavy hole band, right? Because without spin orbit coupling, all the P orbitals are degenerate. You would not just take this particular heavy hole. So the very action that you're taking the heavy hole means you're considering in the limit to a spin orbit coupling is very strong. But within that limit, you can consider then first the 2x2 block of upspin and the 2x2 block of the downspin. Now it's very easy to write down what's the tie binding model for it because you look at the S orbital overlap with S orbital, and now because this now is in the S and P space, now I'm expanding this 2x2 matrix, this is in the SP space. So this, the diagonal, the sigma z component is telling us about the energy difference between S and P. And then this off-diagonal matrix element is talking about the coupling between the S orbital and the P orbital. Now, because they have opposite parity, they cannot couple at a gamma point. So that immediately tells you that the coupling has to be linear in K if you expand it out. And because this is a P plus IP orbital in K, crystal momentum K, you get KX minus IKY and KX plus IKY. So when you take the continuum limit near the gamma point, this is nothing but the 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation. Okay? Now, this statement is actually also true for gallium arsenide. Gallium arsenide is also described by a 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation. It's that just this mass for gallium arsenide is large and positive. The interesting thing about mercury telluride is that this M is small to begin with, but furthermore, the M can be changed in sign because this level difference between S and P is the sigma z. And by changing the thickness, you're changing the mass of the 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac model. And in particular, you can go through zero. So this magic transition that happens at D equals to 6 nanometer, when the S level and P level interchange their place, is the place where the mass changes sign. And at the place where mass changes sign, you have to go through a quantum Hall-like phase transition. But this is a quantum Hall-like phase transition for upspin, and because it's time reversal invariant, the opposite thing happens for the downspin. So it's even more easy to explain. If you don't know about this result, about why a 2 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation having a mass give you a quantum Hall effect, it's much easier to understand if you just solve the model. So if you solve the model for the massive Dirac equation, then you have to identify. But the important thing is that you have to actually you solve the massive Dirac equation, but still with the quadratic term. So it's not exactly the linear part of the Dirac equation up to the quadratic term of the Dirac equation. So then you identify the boundary condition along the x direction, so kx become a good quantum number, and then ky has a finite boundary. So now when the Dirac mass becomes negative, it makes the sample boundary look like a mass domain wall. So this idea of a mass domain wall occurs all over the place in these subjects.
It's a very silly question, but yeah. Suppose this is really like a Hall R.
So yeah.
the things vacuum outside.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. It's a very, very good question. That's why I immediately defined the question more. It's the mass has a sign. That's the difference between S and P. And then there's a quadratic piece. It's the relative sign between these two pieces that defines. You don't need to, you say vacuum is just nothing. And if they have the opposite sign. And the reason is the following. Right? Usually the S band curves up and P band curves down. When S and P collide, you see the mass difference is negative, but the curvature still keeps. And so there's a relative minus sign. And that's to high energy physicists like ultraviolet regulation, for regularization. And then you don't need the vacuum outside. You just solve this model, you will get those edge states. And but it's easier, a little bit easier to explain that outside is like mass positive. So if the SP level changes sign, it's like a phase transition has happened. So you will get this domain wall fermion. But you will get, because this is two copies, right? For upspin, you will get one here, another one here. And for the downspin, you will get one here and one there. Altogether, the system is time reversal invariant. Okay, so that's why this 4 equals to 2 plus 2 is really a fractionalization phenomenon. It's this domain wall fermion that it's splitting one half of a state here and another half of a state here. And the magic about Mercury terahertz is exactly that this happens in a controlled fashion, that you can change the D continuously. So now I kept kx to be zero, let's say, to begin with. But as you change kx, then these two mid-gap states will change their energy. And that's actually nothing but the dispersion of the edge state. Okay? And they cross at this point, and this crossing is protected. So that's the kind of, so I will not show the experimental data because Lawrence will show more and more about that later. So instead, in the spirit of this workshop, let me tell you about something that's relatively new. So we are now looking for the three-dimensional topological insulator, and we heard this morning and this afternoon about all the wonderful property, in particular that the surface is indestructible and it can carry dissipationless current. So in a way, search for dissipationless transport in condensed matter physics is kind of a very important goal, right? We look for superconductivity, and this kind of dissipationless current is yet another example. So first, of course, the strongest motivation is we would like to find some topological insulators at room temperature. But there are also other motivations. So far, the material which Zahid will talk about when he comes next week is bismuth antimony, which is alloy. So alloy is not a single crystal. So when you do calculations, all these momentum quantum numbers for a given alloy distribution, strictly speaking, is not so well defined. You need to do coherent crystal approximation and some kind of mean field theory, and it also can lead you some bulk impurity bands. So whenever we study a new subject, we would like to find something like a hydrogen atom that is very, very simple, that it's just the simplest thing that can be explained theoretically and predicted. So these are the other motivations. So now this is a collaboration with IOP Institute of Physics in China, in Beijing, and Professor Fang Zhong is mainly responsible for doing the first principle calculation, and he will come next week. We can hear more about it later. So there's a class of material, and it's either bismuth 2 selenide 3, or bismuth 2 terahertz 3, or you substitute bismuth with antimony. Okay, so there are four possible combinations. And it turns out that three of them are topological insulators. And bismuth selenide actually turned out to be a topological insulator at room temperature with an energy gap of 0.3 electron volt. Right, so you never, this is really big. So the bismuth 2 selenium 3.
But one of the other compounds was Bi2T.
Yeah. That's also, yeah.
Because that's a very common
very, very good. So this is also...
That
gap is both experimental and theoretical. They agree. Yeah. And so I know Joe also has a hobby, and his hobby is thermoelectric. And it turns out bismuth 2 terahertz 3 is also very, very good thermoelectric, and that's the reason why it's studied. Okay, so the crystal structure, it's quintuple layers. So it has five layer, and between the five layers it's very weakly coupled. So that's another very good thing. You can prepare this by scotch tape method. So that's lovable. It's a method because after all we're going to talk about surface and surface physics. You first need to prepare a good surface, and they just stick a scotch tape piece of a very nice clean surface. So now then this has so you can consider these five layers. You have the middle layer forming an inversion layer, okay, and then you have bismuth, selenium, okay. So then you can substitute selenium by tellurium. You can substitute bismuth by antimony. So out of these four combinations, the only material that's not a topological insulator is antimony selenium. Yeah.
What's the meaning of the label when the two?
Just because it just labels the atomic position within the five layers.
I see.
Yeah. So now this forms an inversion layer. So you can classify states by their parity eigenvalues. Okay. So first you just take, because there are three seleniums and two bismuths, you first form the linear. So for bismuths, it's obvious you form the bonding antibonding orbitals. Now for selenium, you can form bonding antibonding and non-bonding. So there are three splittings for the selenium. Splitting like this, and two bismuths splitting like this.
So are you just talking about a single?
Single, five layer unit cell, yeah. So then there's crystal field splitting, okay? So the crystal is like, you first imagine a cube, and you rotate the cube so that the 111 becomes the z direction, and you distort the cube rhombohedrically.
Actual crystal structures of these materials
yeah. From? Yeah. So then they form this kind of. So first, you form the parity eigenstate, and then you look at crystal field splitting. Okay, so that's ZX is the special, and you form these two Z orbitals close to each other. So then you look at spin orbit splitting. Okay, and then whether it makes it or does not make it really depends on whether the spin orbit can induce another level crossing. So the central theme, you see, when you change the layer thickness of mercury terahertz, right? Because mercury terahertz has stronger spin orbit coupling, fundamentally you are always changing the spin orbit coupling, right? When you're changing the mercury terahertz thickness and inducing this level transition, you're changing the size of the spin orbit coupling. Having more mercury terahertz has more. Now, of course, we can do it theoretically. We just tune a knob to see turn the spin. We know what's the realistic value, but we can follow it. So for this material, it turns out spin orbit coupling will induce additional crossing. Okay, so it makes an inversion to happen exactly like that of mercury terahertz.
But you're still talking about a single layer.
Yeah. So I'm just saying at atomic level. Yeah. So we'll talk about all these. Yeah. No. Yeah, I'm just illustrate the basic concept. I hope that the theme is that when I explain mercury terahertz, explain atomic physics, and you see mercury terahertz, the p3 half splitting is so large, and you know kind of there must be something going on, right? So, and it's this thing that's very, very important. And the thing that's why antimony terahertz does not make it is the spin orbit coupling is not strong enough to make this additional inversion. But the physics is extremely, extremely simple. I really think it could become like the hydrogen atom for this subject because everything is happening at a gamma point. And so this is the surface state on the if you cut a surface that's normal to the z axis, so you see a single Dirac cone at a gamma point, and this material has no Dirac cones.
So is the surface charged?
The surface is not charged. It's theoretical. I will talk about experiment also. Yeah. Of course, the reason is we would like to plot it in a way that it's easier to compare experimentally. Okay.
Surface density of state.
Surface density of state.
I put it in first principle.
I'm asking if the surface, if you integrate the total charge at the surface, whether that's zero.
I think even if it's charge, it must be weak. The quintuple layers form a pretty closed unit.
The layer, between layers, is
Van der Waals.
If there's inversion symmetry, then there has to be an integer number of bands filled, right? I mean, yeah. So doesn't the Fermi energy have to be at the Dirac point?
Yeah, so the Fermi energy in the calculation, you don't really know where is the Fermi energy.
Right, so the Fermi energy is not where he drew it. The Fermi energy is at the top of the valence band.
Yeah, rigorously speaking, you only in the calculation you only know the Fermi energy is in the box.
Right. So the way, so where you drew the Fermi energy
right.
is actually
right. Surface dependent, you mean?
Yeah.
So you need a gauge. The native charge neutral surface would probably be the Fermi energy would be.
Yeah, but yeah, then it, well, yeah, maybe there's some surface reconstruction that could happen.
In relation with here, it's possible that this surface will shift up and down. It's
depending on the details of the surface.
Right.
But the beauty is that there's a single Dirac cone. So for doing all these controlled monopole experiments and so on, right? So we first need to gap it. Now, if you have five bands, it's very hard to juggle and to gap them.
I'm saying it's even better than drawing.
Yeah.
Because I think if you put in the self-consistent Coulomb field, the Fermi energy should be right at the Dirac point. And it should push the Dirac. Either it'll push the Dirac
Or
the Fermi energy will be, you know, it'll be sort of, you know, pinned at the.
So
either the Dirac cone moves to the gap, or that you will get some doping in the block.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are also a possibility that like you have some vacancies, and then it's not neutral. I mean, in the relaxing material.
So the room temperature behavior, I'm referring to this gap, and that's 0.3 electron volts. Okay, so I think so. Now it turns out that people have been maybe for the reason that Joe has this is a popular material, particularly this material. And just early this year, there were surface STM experiments. It looks like there's a surface state. They also come, none of them know anything about topological insulators, but they come, it's very, very strange. If we oxidize it a long time, it's still there. Okay? And the photo emission of this has been done. It's almost like this.
Actually, isn't it sort of backwards? So they have to wait for a long time.
But once it appears, it's very robust.
So it means at the beginning, maybe you have some doping, and then it relaxes to the
So there's 208.
EPL paper.
NOH. Yeah, and it looks almost like that. And single Dirac point. Very close. We need more resolution. But through surface reconstruction, something like that can happen. Yeah.
So how is the resistivity like in these materials?
Resistivity.
Temperature.
Yeah, those paper we looked at were STM and photo emission.
This Bi2T3 is reasonably conducting at room temperature in bulk. It's somewhere bad metal, bad insulated. But of course, its gap looks like a plus one. The gap of this material is only a couple times room temperature.
But this one is huge.
Is it all thermal or?
Is it all thermal?
So also Charlie and Liang, so they also did the parity analysis. So this, of course, the point is that they hope to be directly able to compare with the experiment. But the parity analysis shows that this is non-insulating and this is these are topological. So everything is very consistent. So even at the atomic.
So they aren't sort of Van der Waals coupled. They're more strongly than.
So it will also be interesting to really kind of do something like graphene to this material. If you can make a five-layer device, and then it's a very robust room temperature device.
So what is the experimental status of the selenite?
Selenite, we didn't find that many papers, but it's quite easy to grow, and we're growing them at Stanford.
And the STM also has selenite.
Yeah.
The STM paper on coal has both the bismuth tellurite and bismuth selenite. I think they see the surface things.
STM, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Where's the ARPIS experiment? Doing which one of them?
This is the ARPIS. The ARPIS was down here, yeah. So then it's also very, because of the simplicity of the crossing at the gamma point, it's very easy to construct a continuum effective fermion model. So you basically look at these two levels which are closest to the Fermi energy. Okay, and you have these two levels, and you write down a 4x4 model. So each one will have a spin, and so it's 4x4. So this is so these are the two opposite parity states, and that's kind of the central theme for all of this. You need to get the rock physics out, so it has to be linear in K coupling. And so this is the coupling between the p orbitals, the positive and negative parity p orbitals for spin up, the for spin down, the positive parity, negative parity. And then on the off diagonal, you can go from up spin to down spin, but then you need to flip the spin, and the change of the total orbital angular momentum has to be 1. And that's why it's kx, k plus and k minus, which exactly have orbital angular momentum 1. And this is nothing exactly the Dirac. distorted Dirac model in 3 plus 1 dimension. So this is basically follows closestly to the physics that's happening in the Mercury Territe. And then as you know, you don't have the wonderful thing you can do experimentally by changing the strength of the spin-orbit coupling. Experimentally in Mercury Territe, Lorentz is changing the thickness of the wafer of the Mercury Territe layer. But here you can study it theoretically as a function of the spin-orbit coupling strengths. And as the function of spin-orbit coupling strengths, you see there's a mass inversion that happens.
Experimentally, you can do that, but
don't. Yeah. But then you get into alloy and yeah.
So one more question. So for the first principle calculation, is it done on a single principle layer?
No. The real material. So when they did the parity analysis, they could actually... Oh, the surface. Semi-infinite, no? Semi-infinite. Yeah, using Green's function method by...
Is it Tibani model?
Or no, first principle model.
First principle
We are with interactions. Well, you just need to get the Green's functions, and there's just like when you try to solve a surface problem, right? There's an iterative.
That's for
non-interaction.
Interaction. I think all this DMFT is like a mean field treating the interactions, right?
So the way to do it is they have the first principle calculation in the phase space. You got the wave function, and then they have a way to determine the Wannier function, which is called maximally localized Wannier function. And then use that, you can construct Tibani model, which is not a fit Tibani model from fitting, but a first principle Tibani model. And they use that.
Oh, so they use a tight binding model that they parameterized using a bulk first principles calculation, and then calculated the surface states using that tight binding model.
Yes, but that's not a tight binding model which fits the band structure of the first principle, but even the wave function. Because you start from, you use the maximally localized Wannier.
Yeah, Professor Fang Zhong will come here next week, so. So then also the surface Hamiltonian is extremely simple. It's just sigma dot p, at least along that surface. So this is the summary. So we really hope this workshop will provide even more excitement as we learn about other new results. I hope I kind of gave you a summary. And it turns out that I think all these states really have deep topological classification. You can understand it. And the other nice thing is that I find it quite miraculous that mathematics knows exactly the difference between, well, it knows that they're not the difference, but that they're the same thing, that the theta vacuum is exactly the same thing as the odd number of surface Dirac fermions. We can now, the theory is now powerful enough to predict new materials, new behaviors, and hope the field will grow at least through all the interactions which will happen within these 2 weeks. Thank you. Yeah.
I have a comment for the your mere monopole.
Yes.
Actually, the monopole charge does not satisfy the Dirac quantization.
Yeah, because there's the
charge and the monopole form a mere pair, so we cannot have the charge move freely around the monopole.
Uh huh.
Is this the reason?
Well, but if you here, I'm just taking the limit that the surface is flat. But if you really look at the chunk of material, then if you have this south pole here, there will be a north pole. Mm-hmm. But this is anything like this topological measurement, like say, what does it mean to measure fractional charge in kinetic matter physics? All electrons are integer. That just means fraction charge here and there can be as far separated as you want. And here, as the curvature, radius of curvature become much, much larger than the distance above and below which you do the experiment, the other monopole effect is really minimal. So that's a well-controlled statement to say you are really measuring the monopole. In the same sense, you are measuring fractional charge and spin charge separation.
So maybe I'm the first of being sort of flipping here. Is your monopole more of a monopole than the monopole that's at the end of the bar magnet?
Except that you can control its position, right? It's really something that's moving as a point like particle.
Do that.
Yeah, I think maybe the dion is more important, that it's an anion, that the monopole follows the charge wherever it goes. Okay.
You mentioned that experiments were underway at Stanford on the bismuth cell matter, at least that you're growing. Are you going to do this monopole experiment or the photo emission?
Well, you can do rudimentary experiments first, right? Just measure maybe that's surface conducting, bulk insulating, uppers.
Yeah, what about in the earlier materials? Who is looking for these monopoles?
Oh, earlier material. I think the problem is we didn't quite figure out how to gap it because it has five bands. It's rather hard to gap it. So, but these ones are simpler. Maybe just one Dirac point. It's easier to gap. So it's perhaps more promising. So there's also some very interesting surface chemistry. You may wonder how these kind of things can possibly happen, because usually the good magnetic films we have are metallic magnetic films. But it turns out that in sub-monolayer level, very interesting surface chemistry can happen, that something that's nominally a magnetic, conducting magnetic film, when you deposit at atomic layer level, can become insulating because of the passivation effect with the surface.
So that material that you mentioned was a weak topological insulator?
No, strong.
One of them, you said?
No, we had...
That's
totally trivial, yes.
If it's totally trivial, can you think about it as two end states or zero?
Zero. You see the plot, right?
It's A?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, just general point of discussion. We don't know for sure that if there are two, then we don't see any effects at all. The theory says that it's adiabatically connected.
Right.
It might still be...
Right. Still be interesting. Yeah, I agree. Like in the theta vacuum definition, you can... Right. In an open boundary system, it's not really periodic. So it's only in the sense that if you make it dirty enough, get it to be localized.
Two pi or four pi.
Yeah.
your question.
Yeah.
For the anion theory, yeah. Do you know anything like torus degeneracy or anything?
So far these considerations are for full flat surface.
So there's no way for you to get exactly like which theory.
Huh?
You cannot tell which theory you will get.
But if you put any answer on a torus, you have to quantize. It has to be quantized. So it's seems incompatible with putting it.
The parameter is not rational, right?
Right.
And that means the degeneracy maybe.
No.
I want to say actually, I want to say the alpha squared is a rational number because it's a topological.
I think you have one explanation why you don't need it to be rational here, because when you do in that argument, the relation between the ground state degeneracy and the statistics, you need to take the quantum particles and move it in a large loop. Mm-hmm. And if you do that here, then you need to consider your system on a torus and wind around. But in that case, you will not only see the monopole, but you see its partner. Because in a continuous system, we don't really have a monopole. Right? Okay. You have you have its partner, but it's very far away. But if you do this large loop, you will see it. So I think in that case, you get zero, where it is, so it's consistent.
Okay. So you mean that the degeneracy is one?
Yeah.
The first model you get very the lines.
Yeah, but experimentalists will just define monopole as something that comes from a point charge. You can study its dynamics and measure the magnetic field with S one over E squared and plot is equally true. So maybe we go on next tomorrow.